Good afternoon, you are tuned in to Antuna Afternoon here for Friday, the 19th of August, the year 2016. Jeff Brown, your host today. Today we'll be talking to Perseverance Theater's new production, actors, music Kua, and Bear Player will be here to talk about this music. We'll get the details about Saturday's tea party hosted by Tops, and Dr. Aaron Whitney and students will be here with a preview of tonight's presentation about the Juno Ice Field Research Program. That Writer's Almanac, we're not using it more today on Antuna Afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with low is about 52 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, scattered showers to cloudy skies. High temperatures near 59 degrees. Sunday, scattered showers, mainly before 10 in the morning.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Drug charges against two non-Native men who worked with the South Dakota tribe to set up a marijuana operation raise questions about tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction. Aaron Myros tells us more.
South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley brought charges against two men hired by Flandreau tribal officials to help set up the country's first marijuana resort. On Monday, president of the consulting firm, Eric Hagan, pleaded not guilty to charges including attempt to possess more than 10 pounds of marijuana. Co-conspirator Jonathan Hunt pleaded guilty to a drug conspiracy count. Jackley says after the hearing, the counsel voiced concerns about jurisdiction.
Since the very beginning of this case, I've indicated that the United States Supreme Court, as well as the South Dakota Supreme Court, have indicated that state authorities have jurisdiction over non-Indians all across the state of South Dakota.
Another tribal law expert says when deciding if the tribe, the state, or the federal law has jurisdiction often depends on the type of crime committed. Tim Purdon is the former United States Attorney for North Dakota.
For drug crimes like this, which it's clear that the South Dakota Attorney General's office is viewing this under the laws that allow for the prosecution of quote-unquote victimless crimes on the reservation and committed by a non-native, that the state of South Dakota has criminal jurisdiction.
Purdon says, like states, tribes have the right to explore legalizing marijuana on tribal land. But since marijuana is illegal under federal and state law, tribes need to proceed carefully. Flandreau tribal officials have no comment on the charges at this time. I'm Erin Myros in Sioux Falls.
A Native American chef is hoping to open a restaurant featuring an indigenous menu. As Melody Edwards reports, the chef prepares modern cuisine with healthy traditional foods.
Sean Sherman, a.k.a. the Sioux Chef, grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota and started cooking in restaurants at the age of 13, eventually working his way up to chef. He soon realized he had an opportunity to share the healthy pre-European contact foods eaten by Native Americans. No wheat, dairy, or processed sugar. He started a food truck selling items like alternative Indian tacos made with grilled cornmeal and bison. And he used heirloom vegetables.
Things like Lakota squash and Dakota sunflower and Arikara, yellow bean, Hidatsa, shield beans, and just a bunch of these kind of, you know, just cool heirlooms that are still out there. And, you know, we're trying to create a demand and an education about them.
Sherman is now raising money to move into a brick-and-mortar restaurant in Minneapolis, which will offer dishes inspired by the diets of tribes from the Dakota and Minneapolis territories.
We really believe it's about helping preserve culture and, you know, bringing back health to, especially to the tribal communities. And we hope to see the same kind of business model happening all over the country, and we're hoping that we can help design some of that.
Sherman says he hopes to grow some of his ingredients on site and to work with local Native farmers. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
Tribal college students in Lawrence, Kansas have created the group Haskell Rocks with Standing Rock to assist pipeline opponents camping near a construction site in North Dakota. Haskell Indian Nations University senior J.C. Lamar is one of the student organizers.
Where you have like a supply drive going. It just started something like we were just going to do for Haskell, but it set on fire. Like our posts reach over 7,000 people and it grows like every day. It almost like gives you goosebumps knowing that there's so many people that are on board with this cause.
Some Haskell students plan to travel to North Dakota to show support to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and demonstrators who say the Dakota Access Pipeline project is a threat to water. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Since 1970, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues like treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to June Afternoon. In the studio with me to start off the show is Kelly Rosberg, Austin Roach, and James Sullivan. They're all involved in the New Perseverance Theater play, Peter and the Starcatcher. Thanks for coming down to the station today.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Jeff.
So, James, you're the box office manager. How many times do people want Peter and the Bass Scratcher to?
Yeah, we've had a few different. It's Peter and the Starcatcher. I've had Peter and the Star Trucker called in, and Peter and the Dragon. I was like, I hope that guy didn't get his tickets at Fandango, because we're not doing Peter's Dragon. But we've had we've got good response so far. People are coming. Hopefully, they know they're coming to Peter and the Star Catcher, not Peter's Dragon.
Yeah.
Or Pete's Dragon, right? I hope.
I like Peter and the Star Trackers.
Yeah.
And you're opening tonight.
Tonight, 7:30.
How many people are in the cast?
We have 12 members of our cast, and we have a wonderful balance here. We have four or five from Juneau and four or five from Anchorage, and then you have a five and two from out of town, out of state. Mm-hmm. So a nice big balance for the show, you know, because we'll take this up to Anchorage in a few weeks, and I got my two buddies here from Anchorage right here to help promote the show today.
Yeah.
Kelly, what do you play?
I'm playing Blackstache, and it's an outrageously fun role. I'm having an amazing time on stage with it. And I got Austin here, who's, you know, he's my Peter.
I'm playing Peter, who is the prequel to Peter Pan. So through the course of the show, I start as this lowly orphan who has no name, and I become the Peter Pan that we all know. So,
how close do you stay to the original script, Barry?
The original script,
story.
Yeah, the story. It's based on a book by Richard Berry or
Dave Berry.
Dave
and
Berry. That's
Pearson,
it.
Wrote the book Peter and the Starcatcher, and it's very tight to the novel.
Yeah.
And it's basically a prequel. It's an origin story of where all those iconic characters came from. They kind of came up with that idea. Where does that Peter Pan and Captain Hook.
Yeah.
What made them who they are? You find out tonight.
Give us a rundown of what the plot is like.
Well, basically it starts off where we as a cast are kind of invoking the muse and starting the show together as actors, and then we start with basically the prologue, which is us getting on this ship and creating this space. And then the course of the story goes we adventure into the ship. Lots of stuff happen on the on these two ships, and then we actually get into a shipwreck, and we're stranded on a lost island, an abandoned. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. I'm just saying words.
Yeah, it's an abandoned island.
We don't want to give too much.
We're beating
around the bush a little bit,
just know there are bad guys and then other bad guys.
And a few good guys,
yeah. but a lot of pirates double-crossing other pirates out at sea, and then a big storm comes up and messes up everyone's plans, and then more craziness ensues. It's a wonderful piece that it was done in New York a few years ago, and I was so excited when Art decided to bring it here to Juneau, and because the play itself, it's part musical, it's part farce, wonderful comedy. It's a very touching story with a great heart, much like the original Peter Pan story itself, but also a kind of a modern update on the origin story.
Right.
And a lot of craziness.
And it's kind of like you're seeing a play happen, and we're also telling the story at the same time. So you get to see us as actors being narrators and talking about the story, as and then jumping into scenes where we are the characters that we're portraying. So
yeah, it's a very unique aesthetic and convention that the show is written in, and the style of creating the magic, you know, on stage before your eyes, and not begging you to, you know, not using mechanical or, you know, complicated conventions of doing things. You're watching the actors create it, and so it begs you to almost suspend your suspension of disbelief and just play and just be a kid again.
Yeah.
And so really the way that the show is, you know, it just come with a good imagination and be ready to play.
Yeah.
Where does the comedy come from?
Oh man, life.
Kelly is amazing in it. He is so funny. Yeah, just there's a lot of really, really beautifully written lines, and they're very, very funny. And there's a lot of wordplay in it. I know that the character that Kelly plays, and also another person, John Gallus, who plays Smee, both of them have really funny lines back and forth.
A lot of British humor.
Yeah.
Very, a lot of homages to, I think, a lot of different styles and stories. You know, I see a lot of Monty Python-esque moments and timing and humor. And then some of the great farces that have been, you know, plays. It's really a cool collection of styles. It really creates its own style in the show.
Is the comedy hard to play?
No, it's very well written, I'd say. The writing is supreme.
As an actor and as an audience member.
I don't think so. I think you have so much fun. And like Kelly just said, it is well written. And it's just it's a fun opportunity for us to be very outlandish in our characters.
Yeah.
You know, when you start thinking about to be an actor, you want to be you want to, you know, play the role correctly. You want to make sure you portray it accurately. But in this sense, there's almost no way for you to do some of these characters wrong because they're totally zany. So just have fun. And, you know, our Black Stash and our Peter Pan and our Mrs. Bumbreak, the nanny, are going to be a lot different than any other show. If you see the show again a couple of years from now, maybe some other theater, it could be have a totally different feel because you know, those actors will just have their own fun being crazy on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Opens tonight.
Friday night. It's opening.
What's the run of the play? What's the run of the play?
5 weeks here in Juneau. Then we'll take it to Anchorage for 3. It's a nice run. We'll be running Thursday, Fridays, and Saturdays at 7:30. Sundays at 4. So, yeah, we open tonight. We'll be running through till September 18th, and it's a great play. We've actually had our 2 previews, and we had a few kids come, and we've had some young kids, and they are eating it up. They seem to be loving it. I saw them jumping up in their seats in a good way, not like they were bouncing off the walls ready to get out. They were really having fun.
So it's a family show.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Think of a Pixar movie. Great for the parents and kids alike. You know, it's got jokes for both levels.
Yes.
Who's the director?
Teresa Capon from Anchorage also. She's the new artistic director at Cyrano's in Anchorage. And she's born and raised in Anchorage. She went to New York for a bunch of years. She just came back, and she's known Art Roach for a bunch of years, and they've talked about getting together. And this is her first chance to direct here. It's been a wonderful experience.
All right. I want to thank you for showing up here. Kelly Rosberg, Art, Austin Roach, and James Sullivan. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Come see Peter in the Starcatcher.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 19th of August, 2016. It was on this date, 1829, the French painter and physicist Louis Daguerre presented his photographic process to the French Academy of Sciences. The first actual photograph had been made a couple of years earlier by Joseph Nicéphore Niépce, but the quality wasn't very good. The plate had to be exposed for 8 hours to capture an image. And Daguerre found a better way. He found that if he coated a copper plate with silver iodide, exposed it to light for 20 to 30 minutes, fumed it with mercury vapor, fixed it with a salt solution, he could get a permanent image. He called it a daguerreotype, of course, after himself. Many early photographers died from mercury poisoning using this method, but it was the method that was used. People lined up to have their portraits taken, though they knew you had to sit in blazing sunlight for up to half an hour, trying not to blink, your head clamped in place to keep it still, which is why they had such grim facial expressions. But it was a marvelous, mystifying, even scarifying thing at the time to look at an image of your actual self. It's the birthday of Ogden Nash, born Rye, New York, 1902, wrote 20 volumes of humorous verse and two musicals, One Touch of Venus and Two's Company. Ogden Nash, who said, "Middle age is when you're sitting at home on a Saturday night and the telephone rings and you hope it isn't for you." It's the birthday of Frank McCourt, born Brooklyn, 1930, oldest of seven children, Irish immigrant couple, who moved back to Ireland, to Limerick, when McCourt was 4 years old. His childhood marked by poverty and the deaths of half of his siblings and his father's alcoholism. Came back to America when he was 19, became a high school English teacher in New York City. Wanted to write a memoir for years, but he was too angry and bitter about it. And finally, listening to his young granddaughter playing, he realized he had to write it from the viewpoint of his child self, and that became his book, Angela's Ashes. Here's a poem for today by Wendy Manukin, Favorite Uncle. Our favorite uncle, Stanley, the youngest of five brothers and the most handsome, used to play a game with my sister and me, hiding a nickel and making us choose which hand, clenched behind his back, held the prize. The two of us danced from one foot to the other, giddy with wanting the nickel, of course, and also the wide smile, the bear hug the winner got from Uncle Stanley. But I remember, even in the heat of his attention, how winning hurt a little, my sister completely still, blinking hard. Uncle Stanley had no children. For 20 years he loved a woman who was married to someone else, and when he finally married her, we didn't love him quite as much. He was our same gallant uncle, but distant now, distracted by having what he could no longer long for. Favorite Uncle, poem by Wendy Manukin, from her collection Dinner with Emerson, published by Tiger Bark Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 19 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our next guests in the studio are Musikiwa and Betty Sims. Musikiwa is from
Zimbabwe. Yes.
And you play the mbira.
Yes, I play the mbira. Like I said, mbira is a wooden instrument with metal keys, and it has... like we have been using this, this instrument has been used like for centuries and centuries for our traditional ceremonies, and how to play it, the layout, it has mother's, that's the top, line, and it has like fathers, that's the bottom line, and it has like children's on the right. And we used two thumbs like to pluck the keys, and the right index finger also pluck the children from underneath. So it's a family. When I look at it, to me, it's a family.
And you grew up with the Mbeya?
Yes, I grew up with it, and also I was born into a family of great, great, great Mbeya players, and we use it for healing, the name of Nare is a phone. This is a telephone because it calls someone who's very far away. So it is so special, I would say.
How is
it? A secret instrument.
How is it tuned?
How to tune this? We move them down or move them up. We don't tune them like guitars. When we have different tunings, we have to travel with maybe two or three different instruments, and we keep changing them to play them. We don't play them.
You can't retune it.
Yeah, we can't retune it.
Who are some Mbeya musicians out there that people might have heard of?
Back in Zimbabwe?
Or anywhere. Thomas Mafuno or...
Thomas Mafuno. There's Thomas Mafumo, and there is Mondrik Mchena, Cosmas Magaya, and there is Garkai Trikoti, and there is Jonah Wazara, and there's quite a number of Mbeya players who plays this instrument.
So the tunings are, each player has their own set of tunings.
People they can have same tuning, but they have the way of playing. They have the way of playing because they always meet at a ceremonial house, which will be located in the area. There is a ceremonial house that people contributed, the building materials, to build that house, when they want to go and hang and be asked and be told what to do and be given some advices, go and hang and make friends with people who come from different parts of the world, and they'll go there, and as I said, this is a telephone. People who just come from a different angle of the country, they'll just say, I was just told to come here, and they'll come and they'll live there for months and months, they will be coming to give their prayers, to respect. They want to be close to these secret spirits, who get possessed, who speak through humans. So they will just be there, they like to hear Mbeya's all the time. They like to hear singing and drumming all the time. So not only just Mbeya's, that's the one we play at our ceremonies, we also play drums. You'll find that some people they don't even know the Mbeya, and they know the drums. So when they come to the gatherings, it's important to do both, or to know the family which we all visited to come and hang, what is their favorite? Are they drummers? Are they Mbeya players? If they are drummers, you should start with their own things and then bring yours in. That's how it works.
We're talking to Muzikiwa from Nigeria, Zimbabwe. Also in the studio is Betsy Sims. Betsy, you're in your room, the group that have been taking advantage of wealth of information here.
Yeah, we are very, very lucky. I've been looking forward to bringing Musikiwa to Juneau for several years now, and we're still kind of all pretty amazed and humbled that we have him here, have a musician of this caliber in Juneau.
Now, some people may know this is a thumb piano.
It's what some people call it, yes.
Yes, yeah. That's what they call it, thumb piano.
And you, when you were in the studio the other day, you brought with you a large gourd just that served as a resonator.
Yes, I brought the gourd resonator. You know, like that's the one which we use like to amplify the sound. But that one is made out of fiberglass. But the real one, the traditional one, ones are gourd. You know, like it's just a semi-social.
And I guess fiberglass probably travels better.
Yeah.
Could you sample? Let us a sample, please.
Play a song?
Yeah, I can play. I can play a song. Sure.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The show is tomorrow night, Saturday, 5:30 at Resurrection Lutheran Church.
Hey, as you can, 5:30, Resurrection Lutheran. Hope people can make it.
All right. Thanks a lot for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks so much, Jeff. We are going back. Also, I'm in the studio with Betsy. We are working on my new city. So excited, you know. And, I'm going to share it with you guys. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
a performance by Musikiwa. They'll be performing at 5:30 Resurrection Lutheran Church on Saturday. Tickets are $10 to $20, a sliding scale, depending on how much you can afford to donate. In the studio with me now is Elba Bontrager and Loretta Bevegni, here to talk about Take Off Pounds Sensibly, the organization otherwise known as TOPS. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you
for listening to us.
Tell me about the organization, please.
Well, the organization has been around for at least 50 years that I know of. I think it was established in 1948 in Minnesota or Michigan. And the mission of this weight loss club, Taking Off Pounds Sensibly, is to help each other do it. It's not a diet. We're not into crash diet stuff. What it is changing up here lifestyle, what we're eating, mindful eating, pay attention to what we're eating. And, of course, exercise is a part of it. Exercise is 20% of weight control, and we want people to be fit. I want to be fit and healthy, and we need to eat correctly. The portion control, that's one thing that the TOPS Club teaches the members of the club, is how to measure your portions, think about the portions. And another thing very important is the choice we make every day. When we get up and we're going to put food in our mouth, think, pay attention to what we're putting into our bodies, eating, and then how to control it. Another thing is instruction at our meetings. We have little 10-minute programs that instruct us, teach us about vegetables, fruits, eating, how things work together in our body. And it helps us keep focused on how to reduce the eating so that we're not overeating. That's what causes overweight, is overeating.
I was listening to the radio the other day, and the person who was on the air talked about eating 3/4 full.
Yes, that we have discussed that at our meetings also. It's very important. Another thing that this TOPS Club does for us as members is accountability. We have one meeting a week, 1 hour, 6:30 at the Senior Center. It's free for anyone who wants to attend. And it's not just for weight loss. It's also for fitness, how to be fit and stay fit. So we have the accountability, weigh in. So every week I know, okay, this is what I weigh today. Now next week when I weigh in again, will I weigh less? What can I do to weigh less? And another thing that helps with that is journalizing, making a food log every day, writing down. And we do have the forms and the papers that we can write down what it is that I'm eating in the morning and all day long clear through the night. Okay, next Thursday when I show up in the meeting, and if I have gained weight, I can go back to my food log. That's where it came in. Okay, so then I can try to get away from that in the week that follows after that, and thus control what am I putting in my mouth, and why am I putting this into my mouth? So,
let's talk about tomorrow, too.
Tomorrow, okay. Tomorrow, we have an open house to help people understand what the program is, can do for them, as it has done for us. They can come for free, of course. It's open house. It's a tea party. We're going to have fun. We're going to have various little presentations, maybe 5 or 6 presentations about the program, covering what I just said, portion control, exercise. This is a support group, accountability, instruction, the food log, and lifestyle change. It's a lifestyle change. It's not something that, okay, I'm dieting now for 6 months and then I'm going to drop off and go back to my old way of doing things. That doesn't work.
So it is a lifestyle.
Yes, it's a lifestyle.
And this is at the Orca.
Oh, the open house is at the Orca Room, just past the Frontier Suites. In fact, Frontier Suites owns Orca Room and rents it to us for the open house. It's right beside Domino's in the Valley, and we'd be happy to see anyone who wants to come. It starts at 2 o'clock and runs through 4, but people can come in and out as they please.
So it's something you work on all the time.
Yes, yes.
Mindfulness really is the key.
Mm-hmm.
What's the hardest thing about keeping pounds off?
Motivation.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, if you get disheartened by your slow progress and think about dropping out, remember why you joined the first place. You had a reason.
Cool. You're meeting tomorrow, what time?
2 o'clock. 2 o'clock at the Orca Room in the Valley.
And your regular meetings are?
Oh, our regular meetings are on Thursdays at 6:30 at the Senior Center here in Juneau.
On 12th Street.
On 12th Street.
Mm-hmm. Anything you'd like to add? I'm going to forget to ask.
Just what TOPS can do for us also is let go of the old habits and break through to a better place. Better feeling, too.
And it's a very informal group. It's a very mm-hmm. friendly group.
Mm-hmm.
About how many people show up for the meetings?
Right now, six. Six or seven of us. But across the state, I think we're about 150. They are. There's clubs in almost every big city in Alaska.
I'm thinking that there probably is all around the world.
Yes, it's all across the United States and Canada, and there are some of these clubs in the world. I don't know where. I haven't looked.
Abba Bontrager and Loretta Bevegni, thank you so much for coming by the station.
Yes, thank you, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. The white ibis is one of the Southeast's most abundant wading birds. For many birds in the temperate zone, breeding and nesting are tied closely to the spring season, when there's more warmth, more light, and more food. For a bird like the white ibis, the key factor in nesting has to do with water. White ibises stand about 2 feet tall, and adults are snow white with black wingtips. The long, down-curved bill is an eye-catching red-orange, as are the long legs and bare face. They forage in shallow pools of fresh water, especially for crayfish and small crabs. They'll start to raise their young only when these pools, and the food they contain, are plentiful. And it must be fresh water. Crustaceans captured in brackish water have too high a salt content for the chicks. In some areas, heavy spring rains create ideal shallow pools. In other areas that stay wet year-round, the same rains may flood wetlands and make feeding difficult. White ibises have adapted. They follow a flexible nesting schedule. Depending on the rains, in some areas they nest in late winter. In others, not until late spring or summer. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's 40 minutes past the hour, and we're tuned in to the Juno Afternoon. Our next guest here are here to talk about the Juno Ice Field Research Program. We're having a presentation tonight at 7 at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you. The presentation's actually at 8 tonight. But thank you very much.
And can you tell me the history of the program, how it got started?
Yes, the program was started in the 1940s by Dr. Maynard Miller as a glaciological research program to better understand ice thickness and ultimately climate change. We're actually in our 70th anniversary season this year, and I'm happy to have two of the students with me here for this spot on the radio.
And that's Olivia and Riley. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
How did Maynard Miller start the program?
He started it as a way to gain information about ice thickness for the Navy. And it grew as a research program and then in the 60s and 70s became a research program, an education program for students, which is really the flag that it bears today. It's a glaciological and expeditionary field training program. For 2 months every summer, the students start in Juneau at the end of June and then make their way across the ice field to Atlin, British Columbia by mid-August. And they stay in a series of permanent camps along the way, using their skis and their crampons to go out and participate in a variety of research projects with scientists who fly on and off the ice field by helicopter. And the science is cutting edge, it's fun, and we always not only discover new things, but also just have a ball in the process.
What occupies your time? Describe one of the experiments for me.
One of you?
Well, as a student, there's lots of different research opportunities. I myself worked on a geophysics project, and so I was looking at how melt water influences how glaciers move, and with climate change, how that's going to develop over the coming years. We also had a lot of field activities in which we could explore the ice field, and it was very, very interdisciplinary.
Really? Is that one of the projects you worked on?
I worked on the ongoing mass balance project, testing to see what the health of the glacier is this season. And so I was out most days digging snow pits to figure out how deep this year's snowfall was.
Is there such thing as a normal day?
Every day we have a plan of the day, and so that keeps constant. Certain things like work detail can always be counted upon. But beyond that, our time was pretty varied. Some days I'd be out digging pits. Other days we could be exploring peaks or rappelling into crevasses. So they definitely kept things interesting for us.
What kind of food did you eat?
The food was actually amazingly good for the ingredients that we had sent up. You can count on 1,000 different ways to cook Spam, and lots of oatmeal, but we had fresh vegetables and fruits shipped up. Those were always the best days, and it was really, really neat to see all the different students come together and put their collective recipes in the pot, and we ended up eating really, really well throughout our 6 weeks on the ice field.
How far do you travel away from the base camp?
Overall, the ice field is about a 90-mile traverse from Juneau, and we end in Atlin in Canada. Some days, when we travel from our main base camps to a new one, we could cover upwards of 18 miles. But those were the most extreme days, and generally we were doing day trips out of camps, which were about 4 or 5 miles out and then back.
If you've lived in Juneau for a while, you've research team is a friendly faces walking in the parade, but you can't get in the parade because of timing these days.
Yes, we start in late June, and it's really imperative that we start before the parade, unfortunately, just because the ice field is ablating during the season, and if we were to wait until after the 4th of July parade, we'd have a lot of blue ice that we would be walking on and a lot more exposed crevasses. It's an ongoing challenge. When I was a student 20-some years ago, we did walk in the parade, but the timing of the program has moved up to accommodate changing conditions.
Riley, where are you from?
I'm from Northern California, a small gold mining town called Sutter Creek, and I go to school in Los Angeles, California.
And Olivia, where are you from?
I'm from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and I went to college up in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Had you ever seen a glacier before you arrived in Juneau?
I had seen a glacier before I arrived in Juneau, just once, in New Zealand, which is actually the glaciers here in Juneau are temperate glaciers, and you guys have your temperate rainforest, and there's only one or two other places in the world that have that, and the west coast of New Zealand is one of them. And that's where I first saw a glacier and fell in love with studying glaciers.
This is the first time for you, too?
This is my first experience with a glacier, yes.
What surprised you most when you arrived there?
I think I was most surprised. I knew coming to Juneau and doing this program that I'd be doing a lot of science, be challenged physically and mentally. But I think I was most surprised by the community that was built up on the ice field. JERP has a special way of creating an all-inclusive culture and a lot of love between the scientific expedition members that really knocked me off my feet.
Besides the experience that you two did, what were some other experiments?
We had six student project areas this year. We had the geophysics team that Riley was on and the mass balance team that Olivia was on.
What do you mean by mass balance?
Mass balance. This is where they determine the annual amount of mass accumulation or loss on the surface of the ice field. So it gives us the health of the ice field, whether it's growing or whether it's shrinking. So balance just refers to that annual annual calculation, if you will. Other project areas included a botany project where species of plants were cataloged all across nunataks on the ice field. Nunataks are the rocky areas that stick up on the ice field. We had a geobiochemistry project where they were looking at stream chemistry and ion concentrations. We had an isotope project using isotopic signatures to tease out weather and precipitation patterns across the ice field. And the final project area was a GPS or Global Positioning System survey project, which is also about 20 years running now, where we look at how the glacier is how the glaciers on the ice field are moving, and how the elevations are changing as well on the ice field. So we're very, very excited about these project areas, and we're really excited to convey some of this tonight at the 8 p.m. Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center open house as well.
Makes you think a lot more about glacier global warming.
Certainly. One of the things that surprised me was I knew that I would be studying global warming this summer as we were scientifically based on the health of the glacier and my specific project area, looking at how the mass of the ice field has changed over time. But I was really struck by the memory that JERP has of the changing ice fields as a community, like talking to staff members who come back year to year and can remember skiing down a hill that's now exposed bare rock, so we hike down. Or they remember being able to ski all the way from our camp up at 17 down to our camp in Canada at 26. But now the health of the ice field is such that we take off our skis and walk for miles over blue ice. And the way that the JERPers are personally connecting with the way the climate is shaping and changing the Juneau ice field, I found just incredibly powerful and really, really informative.
What's happening tonight? You just going to describe the projects you worked on?
We're going to have actually more of an open house format. We will have a number of stations that are all each centered around a particular theme. And some of these themes include everything from how do we manage hazards on the ice field to what are the academic components of the ice field program to what would the ice field area look like if all the ice were gone? You know, would it be big valleys? Would it rival Yosemite? Other questions we're trying to ask are, what life exists on the ice field. So we'll have a group of students detailing some of the botany work that they've done. We're trying to have a much more interactive and intimate format, and the way we came up with these questions was to ask ourselves what kinds of questions our friends and our families and our colleagues ask us. And I think it will be very interactive, and I hope those who are able to come will join us.
It starts at 8 o'clock in the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. How many students are going to be making presentations?
We have 32 students, and they'll all be divided into these different stations so that community members can wander around and talk with the students about these different questions that the stations are centered around.
What percentage of the crew are veterans?
Are veterans?
Veterans, they've been there before.
Well, our staff members, of whom we have about 9 this year, are all former JERP students. That's actually a requirement for being a staff member. Our students are all first-time JERPers, and we might even get some staff out of them in the coming years as well.
And JERP stands for the Juneau Ice Field Research Program?
That's correct, yes.
Very policy about acronyms here.
Thank you.
8 o'clock tonight at Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Thank you so much for coming down. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Just please come and ask us lots of questions. After 6 weeks on the ice field, we're really excited to share all of our incredible experiences with everyone down in Juneau.
Was it difficult not being connected to the Internet?
Yeah, I would say difficult at first and ultimately totally refreshing. And a little hard to come back, and we're all now back on our phones.
All right, thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So high.
Sponsored in part by Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall. Serving Juneau since 1978, Ron's Apothecary is providing medication information, nutritional supplements, and homeopathic remedies. More information at ronsapothecary.com.
The Rotary Club of Juneau is proud to present the 5th Annual Capital Brewfest coming September 17th at the Jack from 1 to 5 p.m. Even more brewers from across Alaska this year, as well as great local music and food. Proceeds benefit the humanitarian works of Rotary and Juno Stop Heroin Start Talking. Come and drink beer for a cause. Tickets are limited and this event will sell out, so buy yours at capbrewfest.com.
Steve Turay, closing out this program on the June afternoon. Next Monday on the June afternoon, Lori Scanley will be your host. We'll talk with programmer Shay Wilson about Thursday's workshop, Think Like a Computer. We'll talk with former Juneau resident Britt Artisan about her new CDs. Listen to Writer's Almanac, Burnout Music, and more today. Monday at 3 on the June afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, patchy fog after 1 in the morning. In the afternoon, that's at 1 in the morning. Forecast for Saturday, scattered showers mostly after 10 in the morning. Saturday night, a 40% chance of rain, cloudy skies otherwise. Forecast for Sunday, a 30% chance of rain before 10 a.m. Thank you.
This is KTOO Juno.